Blog Talk Radio.
Quiet, please. Welcome to Rex Sykes' Movie Beat, conversations with filmmakers where we discuss everything film and television. Here on Movie Beat, you learn what to do and what not to do when it comes to making movies and TV, and we will talk to everyone behind the scenes and in front of the camera, and I'll provide you with the guests and the information you're going to want to have, whether you're a filmmaker or a fan. And so now let's move behind the scenes here at Movie Beat. My guest today is Mr. Billy Ray. Billy is the screenwriter of Captain Phillips. He also wrote and directed the films Shattered Glass and Breach, and he co-wrote the screenplay for Hunger Games. He's on his third term as a board of director of the Writers Guild of America. He's going to be coming up in just a moment, and I'm thrilled that he's here with us. We're going to talk about Captain Phillips. We're going to talk about Somali pirates and what's going on in Somalia, and all sorts of other things. But first, let me say welcome. I'm your host, I'm Rex Sykes of Rex Sykes Movie Beat. The official URL is rexsykes.com. That's my name, rexsikes.com. You can listen live right from the interviews blog at rexsykes.com. But all of the interviews, over 400 hours of professional filmmakers sharing their expertise with you, is available 24/7. Any time of the day or night, you can listen to professional filmmakers sharing their expertise, giving you secrets, tips, advice, so you can advance your career and move forward on your projects easier, faster, and less expensively. All right. So all we ask in return is that you share the website, you share these interviews with your friends and your colleagues. You can get them from Blog Talk Radio. You can get them from RexSykes.com. You can get them from iTunes. And whenever you go to any of these sites, please rate and review the shows. And give us a high rating. That's always great because it increases our visibility on the internet so that other people who may not yet be familiar with what we're doing here can become familiar with it by stumbling on it right there on the internet. So thank you very much for your support, your letters, your calls, for meeting in person, telling me you listen to the show. I really do appreciate it. The chat room is open. If you're listening live, you can join us in the chat room. And we're so glad you're here. I'm going to bring Billy on right now. Billy, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm so glad that you're here.
And, thanks for having me.
Oh, you bet. I'm eager to talk with you. And you know, a friend of mine says hi. Chris Mulkey was in Captain Phillips and was very, very keen to know that you were on the show today.
Oh, look, he did a great job.
Wow, that's very cool. The movie was fantastic. I really did like it, and it's immense in scope, and now it's controversial. I mean, there's some controversy over it and everything else. But what really impressed me beyond Tom Hanks and the American cast was the pirates, incredibly well acted by everyone.
Well, you know, the story behind that, and the credit for this goes primarily to two people, Paul Greengrass, who's a spectacular director, and Francine Mazler, who is a spectacular casting director. They wanted a very specific feel for those pirates, and they didn't want anyone who felt like an actor. So they went into Minneapolis, which strangely has a large Somali community, actually the biggest Somali community in America, and they found these four guys who were not actors. There was a general casting call, and these four guys, I think two were from Somalia and two were from Yemen. They had known each other growing up. They were all in Minneapolis. They decided to respond to the casting call. They rehearsed together as a group, the four pirates, and auditioned together, and they were cast together. None of them had ever acted before. And I think that's why there's that sort of natural realism to their performance.
It is really impressive, and to be, you know, to understand that they may not have acted much or at all is even that much more impressive.
Because, well, that's Paul.
Well, that's very good. But now you're a writer, but also as a director. And when you say that's Paul, can you talk maybe a little bit to that in terms of a director working with actors to make things believable?
Sure. There are times when you're looking for something very specific in terms of a character, and that specific has to do with the absence of a polished performance. I'm sure that's probably the wrong usage, but you're looking for someone who doesn't act like an actor would act in a given circumstance. And I've done that once or twice myself, never to the degree that Paul did on Captain Phillips, where I really thought the choice was extraordinary and very bold, and then the execution was even better. But in this particular case, if you had actors who were recognizable faces playing those Somali pirates, it just wouldn't have the edge, it wouldn't have the grittiness, and therefore it wouldn't have the tension and the terror that those four guys bring. Part of what's so dynamic about those performances is you have no idea what they're about to do. And that is exactly the experience that Captain Phillips had, and that's why I think it was such a smart choice by Paul.
No, that's really good. I like that. How did you come to write Captain Phillips, and what kind of, being that it's a historical drama, how the kind of research and effort that you need to put into something like that?
Sure. I watched the story unfold on CNN like everybody else. I didn't really think of it in terms of its potential as a movie until the story resolved itself, when I realized this guy survived and he's okay. Then it began to feel like a movie, but I didn't have any plans to do anything with it. Then I was made aware that Sony was acquiring the life rights to Captain Phillips and that it was going to be an open writing assignment. It became something that I wanted very badly. I knew that it was a little bit of a beauty pageant. In other words, a lot of writers were going to chase it, but it was just something I determined I was going to go get. So the way that you do that, if you're going after an open assignment, is you just have to put in the sweat equity. You have to be the guy who's the best prepared when you go in for your meeting at the studio. And in this particular case, I had a leg up just because I had made movies before that were true stories, and so I had a little bit of a reputation for some facility with that, which I think made it easier for them to choose me.
Wow. Few people, those that do, are able to experience that, and many others aren't. They've got scripts or they've read spec scripts and things like that. How does it differ when you're a professional writer, say in your case, versus the people trying to break in? I might write a script tomorrow, but that doesn't put me anywhere on the map. So what kind of lifestyle difference is there for a professional writer that young writers, and by young I mean young in the field, need to know?
Okay. Well, there are really two components to that question. The first you have no control over, which is luck. And I have been extremely fortunate in my career in that from the time I started, I had people around me who were rooting for me to succeed and were trying to help me succeed and were very encouraging. On its most basic level, I was born in America. That's a huge advantage. I was born to two parents who could afford to educate me. That's a massive advantage. My father, for 32 years, was a literary agent, so I had a sort of a growing knowledge of the business and how it worked as I was maturing. All that stuff, there's nothing to do but just thank God. I caught a lot of breaks. Then there's the second component to it, which is just the hard work part of it. There's no substitute for it. And I know a lot of people who have caught breaks and who haven't matched that with a certain level of hard work and intensity. And what you find is that those people, they fall by the wayside. People, I think, in this business, where they get into trouble is when they start to think of it as art and they don't think of it as work. you have to approach it every single day like a job. In other words, I get up in the morning, I take my son to his bus stop at 7:30, I'm at my desk at 8 o'clock, I work until 1 when I have lunch, I'm back at my desk probably 1:15, writing until 6. And that's all I do. I'm not goofing off on the web. I'm not, you know, looking for ex-girlfriends on Facebook. I'm not, you know, gambling, you know, over the internet. I'm just working. And that's the only way that I know how to do it. I'm not talented enough to do it any other way. So to circle back to Captain Phillips, I approached this as in the same way that I would approach anything that I either wanted to work on or was working on, which was, how can I throw myself into this completely and wholly so that I can walk into that meeting as bulletproof as I can possibly be, completely prepared. Now, they may still choose somebody else, but I will walk away from that meeting knowing that I did everything I could humanly do to get that job. And I have found that if you approach it in that way, you know, the breaks start to come your way.
I really appreciate what you've said. I spoke recently with the writer who's had some success in Hollywood, and he said, you know, people think, you know, it's sitting around, you know, writing and everything. He said, but once you have a certain level of success, he goes, it's really a job. I mean, he's like, it's a job. It's a job.
Oh, there's no question about it. And you know, the best advice about that I read in an interview maybe 25 years ago with Paddy Chayefsky, who had already won 3 Academy Awards. So you would think if there was anyone who could coast, it would be him. And he's
right.
The one who said, don't think of it as art, think of it as work. Because if a writer gets stuck and he or she calls in a second writer for help, that second writer doesn't come over and say, what's the art problem? That second writer comes in and says, what's not working? And they get under the hood and they fix it. And if you approach them that way, at the end of every single day, you'll be able to say, I did my job today. And Chayefsky added, if you're an artist, it'll come out as art anyway. But you have to approach it like it's work. I mean, when I hear about writers who sit in Starbucks all day and just talk about writing, I know those are people who are going to lose jobs. Because it's not about talking. It's literally just about sitting there and doing it. 90 to 95% of what you do as a writer is just problem solving. I don't spend any time thinking, okay, how can I artistically do this? I just think, okay, here's the problem. I got to get this character from A to B. How can I make that function as efficiently as possible? That's all you do as a writer. And the rest of it is the rest of it is just, well, I can't say what it is over here, but it's just ridiculous.
Well, I appreciate that too. You know, and you're also a director. I mean, you wear multiple hats, and I think a lot of filmmakers think, you know, I made a film and it's art, and or it's important and it's a story, but they don't embrace what I think you've hit very successfully on the head here is the notion that it's a business, and if you're writing, it's a business. If you're directing or filmmaking or producing, you know, that side of it is so much, you need so much to apprehend it, to learn it, to embrace it, as opposed to do otherwise. Would we be correct in saying, assuming that?
Well, sure. You know, I can't predict how the business is going to react in any given moment. You know, there's so many variables that are outside your control when you make a living in the entertainment industry. You can't control the health of the economy as a whole. You can't control the health of our industry. You can't control whether or not the DVD market is going to flatten out. You can't control what is going to happen on new media. You can't control whether or not superhero movies are in or out or thrillers are coming back. You can't control any of it. The only thing you can control, the only variable you can control, is your willingness to work hard. So you just have to maximize that variable. And as it applies to the two movies that I've directed, both Shattered Glass and Breach, they were reflective of that. And by that I mean you're not going to get a $60 million budget to make those movies. You're just not. The realities of the business are such that if you want to make those kinds of movies, you're going to have to live inside a pretty tightly confined box in terms of budget. And to me, it was very much worth it. I was willing to live with the realities of the business because it gave me an opportunity to direct and then to direct a second time. I'd rather do that than be behind the camera of a $120 million movie that I didn't believe in as much.
Very, very good point. Now, since we're talking about the business, you're a third-term board member of the Writers Guild.
Yes,
can
sir.
Can you talk about that? I mean, the Writers Guild and about becoming a professional writer and the path that writers may take and anything you want us to know about the Guild itself.
Okay, well, I'll tell you how I became a writer. As I said, my father was a literary agent for 32 years and a great one. He represented people like Alvin Sargent and Frank Pearson and Paul Brickman and Peter Bogdanovich. So I always had a sense of the difference between great, great work and just average work. And from the age of about 15, 16 on, I knew I wanted to write. When I got out of college, I was working as a gopher for two TV movie producers, just, you know, driving cans of film around or picking up their tuxedos or whatever they wanted me to do, and reading everything that came through the office. Because the only way to learn, particularly this type of writing, is you just have to read a lot and commit yourself to learning as much from the bad scripts that cross your desk as you're going to learn from the good ones. And I was writing at night. And then as I grew within that company and I became sort of a half-assed executive for them, I had less and less time to write because I was reading for them. That was part of my job by that point. So when I hit, I don't know, maybe 21 or 22, I realized I only had Sunday nights available as writing nights. Every other night of the week, I was reading for my job. So Sunday night was just an almost religious experience. I wasn't doing anything but writing because it was the only night I had. And you learn during that process at the age of 22, okay, my friends are all going out on Sunday nights and getting hammered and chasing girls around, and I'm willing to forego that because I want something else more, which teaches you, okay, that's now I know what my priorities are. So on Sunday nights, it took me about a year, but I wrote my first novel, couldn't sell it. Then I put it aside and for another year wrote another novel on Sunday nights, couldn't sell it. Wrote my first script, didn't sell it, then wrote six more drafts of that script and finally sold it, but for such a tiny amount of money that it wasn't even enough for me to quit my job. However, having sold that script was enough to call myself a professional writer, so I was able to walk into Fox with a pitch and sold that pitch. This was January 8th, 1988, and then I did have enough seed money to quit my job and try to make a go of it as a writer. Within 2 months, I was involved in my first strike because I happened to have the misfortune of joining the Guild 2 months before the 1988 strike, which turns out, you know, sort of taught me a lesson about things that are out of your control. But I've been making a living as a writer since then. I became a member of the board of directors of the Guild in 2009. And the reason that happened was because I was not a terribly involved Guild member until the strike of 2007, 2008. And then I found myself, you know, walking around in a circle all day with a picket sign with a couple hundred writers outside of Fox. And I thought, as that was happening, this is affecting my career too profoundly for me not to understand more about the Guild and how it works and why this is happening. So I sort of threw myself into Guild politics at that point. And I've been sort of up to my eyeballs in it ever since.
Wow. So the advantage for I mean, obviously, if somebody's going to work in Hollywood, they're ultimately going to end up becoming a member of the Writers Guild.
Absolutely.
And the advantages of that, I mean, why does somebody want to become a member? Is it?
Well, you really can't work in Hollywood as a writer unless you are a member of the Guild. And the reason for that is that the Guild is there to protect writers and does, I think, a very, very good job of it. The Guild is a wildly misunderstood organization. I know that I misunderstood it before. I was sort of under the hood of it. But what it's there to do is protect people who don't have the wherewithal to stand up to, you know, a massive media corporation. You know, there's so much consolidation in the business now. There's so few corporations that own everything. No one writer can stand up to an organization the size of Comcast and expect to have any success. But the Writers Guild can and does, and that's what it's there for. You know, without the Writers Guild, there would be no such thing as minimums. There would be no such thing as residuals. There would be no such thing as pension or health benefits. You know, these are things that make a middle-class living for writers possible, and they were all achieved through our forefathers in the Guild.
I appreciate that because I'm a member of the Screen Actors Guild, or now SAG-AFTRA, and I have always felt, you know, that what people misunderstood about that particular union is the idea that it should get you work where it doesn't, but it does protect you you have work.
And, that's right. The guild is not a union hall. It doesn't function, for example, in the same way that, you know, the merchant mariners have a union, and that's it fulfills a very different function. But it is there to protect you. You know, I talk to writers all the time who don't know what to do if their delivery checks are late, or if they've been asked to do free rewrites on something, or if they've been asked to come in and write a spec act one for a movie just to get the job to write the rest of the movie, and they're in competition with five other writers who are also being asked, illegally, by the way, to turn in pages to get the job, and they don't know where to turn, and the place to turn to is the Guild, and the Guild will protect them without fail.
What does someone have to do now to become a Guild member? Can we approach that a bit?
Well, yeah, it depends on where you are. If you're trying to join the Writers Guild of America West, there are membership standards that have to do with, you know, having sold a spec script or having been hired to work in television or film or new media. And you can go to the Writers Guild of America West website and you'll see there what you have to do to qualify to join the Guild. It's a pretty inclusive organization. And then once you're in, you know, there's a membership entrance fee that you pay, and then there are dues that you pay, which are directly related to your earnings. It's a point and a half of whatever you earn. And then you start to vest at a certain point, and you become qualified for pension and health benefits and all the other things that union membership is there to provide.
Very cool. So can I ask, you know, there are today, probably more so than ever in the history of movie making, mm-hmm. With the idea that anyone can pick up a camera from, you know, Best Buy or anywhere, and you can get editing software, you can get script writing software, you can get music making software. I mean, you know, more so than, I mean, one time you had to at least purchase raw stock. The
right.
Investment was much more considerable, you know, in those days. Than it is today in many ways, but you know, we are inundated or over inundated with movies, and it's the same I would guess about screenplays. I mean, imagine that there's so many people writing. Somebody the other day, and I've heard this before, saying, you know, if you have a group of friends and one of them sells a screenplay, then all the other friends say, okay, I'm going to write a screenplay too.
Sure.
That
sure.
Everybody
and all the friends' cousins.
Exactly. So immediately when somebody, you know, kind of pops with something, then everybody else thinks, well, that's easy. I can do that. I'll do it as well. But, I mean, there must be just, you know, an incredible wealth of screenplays out there. And you're dealing, I mean, you know, Captain Phillips, The Hunger Games, your movies, Breach, and you're dealing, I'd have to say, at a different level than most people get to experience. And is there a criterion that you think is important for writers when they're writing, you know, to think about how to one, learn the craft and then make what they do, you know, compelling so that people want to buy it as opposed to, you're sitting on somebody's desk and go, okay, I've got 200 more I need to read? I mean,
well, there are two components to that question as well. I think that there are there is a part of writing that can be taught, and there's a part of writing that cannot. The part that can be taught is story structure. And, you know, when I was in my 20s, I went and took Robert McKee's class, and it blew the top of my head off. I mean, he was able to articulate things that felt very true and yet that I had never thought before. I don't know that I would have been a writer had I never taken that class. My debt to him is not a small one. And I've done a lot of guest lecturing, you know, at various film schools all over the country, talking about how to structure a story, because I do believe that there are basic rules to it that can be taught and therefore can be learned. And anyone has access to that. That's not a difficult thing to figure out. The part of writing that can't be taught is, do you have an ear for dialogue? Do you have the ability to create memorable characters? There's a little more magic to that part of it, which I think just has to do with innate ability. By the way, you can make a living without a lot of that second component. Just knowing how story structure works could be enough to get you a career in the industry and even a career in writing, because it is a little bit of a lost skill, just the basic knowledge of how to structure a story. If you have both components, you know, then you have a real shot at a career.
Excellent. I mean, that's very good, very sound advice. I want to ask a question from our chat room, and then when we're done, just so you know, we'll take a break. And I want to come back and talk about some of the Merchant Marine and the issues of the Somali piracy with you as well.
Okay.
And we'll continue talking about writing and directing. But the question in the chat room is I'm interested in hearing what unique challenges Mr. Ray faced when writing a script based on a historical event as opposed to creating, you know, a story world.
Sure.
And also, second part, does he find that his experience as a director shapes his work as a writer?
Okay, I'll answer the second part first because it's a shorter answer. It absolutely changed the way that I wrote. It helps me to become a little more spare in the way that I write, because once you're on the set of a movie, you begin to understand how much actors bring to a production and how much can be done with a look that you thought needed a paragraph of fancy dialogue. It's extremely humbling in that way. So, yes, directing absolutely changes the way that you write, particularly if you're writing something that you're going to be directing. Because if you are going to be the dummy with the camera, you better write something that's filmable. It's not going to be someone else's problem. It's going to be yours. So, yes, that impacts it significantly. As to the first part, there are certain obligations that come with telling a true story, in that you just have to get your facts straight and you have to be telling the truth, or at least you have to be telling something that is extremely true to the spirit of events, of what actually took place. When I was making Shattered Glass, the bar for that was very, very high because the story was about fraudulence in journalism. So if I told that in a fraudulent way, you know, shame on me. You just can't do that. When I was making the movie Breach, that was about a guy named Robert Hansen who had worked for the FBI for over two decades and had been spying for the Russians for 22 years of that. There are certain things in that story that are matters of historical record that you just had to get right. And the same is true when you're working on Captain Phillips, although I think it's even more true because it was a story that was very well known and was very recent. You know, the whole thing only happened in 2009, and I started writing that movie, I don't know, it was either 2010 or 2011, but it was pretty much right on the heels of the event itself. So you can't put anything in there that everyone knows to be untrue. Those are the obligations that face you when you're writing a movie that's based on a true story. However, the flip side of that is I've always felt to my core that when you're telling a true story, it's more of an opportunity than anything else. And by that I mean, I couldn't have created the character of Captain Phillips. I couldn't have created the character of Musi, who's the lead pirate. I couldn't have done a better job with that than God did. You know, I mean, God handed me those characters. What a great gift.
Really?
I have always felt that there's something about real life behavior, real life people, the idiosyncrasies of human behavior, the specificity of human behavior, so perfect in its imperfections. I would much rather be trying to tell the story of someone who really existed than have to create someone out of whole cloth and then tell their story. I feel more authentic when I'm writing those kinds of movies. I understand the rules of those movies better. And I like the challenge of having to get it right.
That's excellent. That's truly, truly fascinating. I just to throw it out there, for an opinion. You know, when I grew up, I was a huge fan of Harry Houdini, and you know, the original movie with Tony Curtis ends with Houdini dying in a torture cell, something he had done for, you know, about 15 years prior to his death successfully. I mean, it had nothing to do with how he died, but that's the
He died because he got punched in the stomach.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and they don't even know if the punch resulted in the appendicitis, or if he had appendicitis prior to the punch. So I mean, there's all this mystery around his death. But the subsequent movies, with the exception of Pendentiums, I believe, you know, have him die in the torture cell or something related to that. And I was very incensed as a young person, thinking, you know, they should have at least done it historically. And you know, you read that, well, it was more interesting if he died. Anyway, my point is this, or my question is, you know, Argo came out and people were, well, it's not exactly true. And maybe I've mellowed in my old day age, you know, but I go, it's a movie. I mean, it's based on a true story, but it's not, I mean, it's not a news report unless it's purporting to be, or unless it's purporting to be a documentary.
That's right.
So I feel less inclined to be pissed off, I guess, if it's not exactly historically accurate, because I understand the constraints. It's 2 hours versus the time it took to unfold. You have to compress
right.
things.
I happen to love Argo. I think it's a truly fine movie, a brilliant screenplay, brilliantly directed by Ben. I'm a very big fan. And I understand the rules that apply to a movie like that. Take, for example, Captain Phillips.
Well,
you know,
this is what I meant.
Captain Phillips, once he got off of the Maersk Alabama and got into that lifeboat with four pirates who were carrying AK-47s, he was in that lifeboat for 4 days, okay? We're not telling a movie that takes place over the course of 4 days. We've got 2 hours and, I think, 14 minutes to tell that story.
Right.
You're going to have to make compressions. You're going to have to composite events into one another to a certain degree. I find the movie to be kind of shockingly accurate in terms of the event choices that we made. But as I said, we only had 2 hours to tell the story. So what you're looking for in general, the basic rule of thumb, as I said, is you have to be true to the spirit of events as they took place. You know, in Breach, there's a scene where Chris Cooper takes Ryan Phillippe out to a forest and he fires a gun at him in a circle. And that scene never took place, but it was extremely true to the spirit of events in that the character Eric O'Neill, played by Ryan Phillippe, was literally locked in an office that was like a vault with this guy, Robert Hansen, who was armed to the teeth. They were stuck in this soundproof room together for weeks, and Eric O'Neill's life was very, very much in jeopardy at all times. He always believed he was about to get shot by Robert Hansen. So I physicalized that experience to make it visual and to make it more visceral. It was completely true to the spirit of events of their story. It was fabricated in that it didn't actually happen in the setting where I put it. But I think it completely fits inside the movie and fits within the framework of the rules of telling a true story.
I think that's absolutely a valid point, and I really do appreciate it. And I'm having a great time with you, Billy. This is fascinating. I'm going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back.
Okay.
So you're listening to Rex Sykes Movie Beat. The official URL is RexSykes.com, RexSykes.com, where all of these interviews are archived and available 24/7. Please do share these interviews with your colleagues and your friends, and tweet about it and Facebook it and use your favorite social media means, and always rate and review the shows whenever you listen, whenever you can. Please leave comments at the player or at iTunes, because that, again, helps increase our listenership. And you're listening to Mr. Billy Ray, the writer of Captain Phillips and Hunger Games and director of other movies as well, and we're having a fascinating time. So please do share this. And know that I've got other fascinating guests coming up in the near future, so stay tuned to Rex Sykes Movie Beat to listen to them. You can find out more on Facebook at Rex Sykes Movie Beat Friends. By the way, you can follow me at Twitter at Rex Sykes Movie BT, and so do that. And we're going to return right now with Mr. Billy Ray. Billy, let's do talk some now about the life of a merchant mariner and what's going on in Somali with the Somali piracy. And
right.
I know this is near and dear to you, so let's...
Very much so. You know, the merchant marine, which I knew very, very little about before I took on this project, there is a long and great history to the merchant marine. The merchant marine was actually the first service academy ever formed in the United States. Before there was an army and before there was a navy, there was a merchant marine. Merchant mariners were the first Americans killed in World War II. There was a lumber hauler that was sunk 17 minutes before Pearl Harbor off the coast of Honolulu. Merchant mariners died at a higher rate in World War II than any other service branch in the military. These are the guys who brought the tanks to Normandy. What MacArthur said about them was, they brought us our lifeblood and they paid for it with their own. But, you know, the merchant mariner, at the end of that war, there was no GI Bill for merchant mariners. There was obviously no ticker tape parades. There was no combat pay ever paid to merchant mariners. And yet they just keep doing their job. You know, 90% of the products that we use in the United States are brought to us overseas. And that's all merchant mariners. The motto of the Merchant Marine Academy, which I believe is in Massachusetts, is acta non verba, which means deeds, not words. And that's how these guys live. They are in this incredibly dangerous atmosphere. You know, there's this great quote Mark Twain once said, going to sea is like going to jail, but with a chance of drowning. Which is sort of how I feel about being on the water. And yet these guys behave by this code of ethics, which is, we are here for the ship. The ship is not here for us. You can see it very much in Captain Phillips and the way those guys behave. It was very important to me in the construction of the movie and in the way Paul told the movie that we honor the sacrifices of the merchant marine. And I feel very, very good about the fact that we did.
Excellent. What and we'll come back and we'll talk about the pirates. But what is it like to write a movie and then like this, you know, and with the scope of this, and then see it translated into, you know, a physical reality, something you can watch on screen? For you as a writer, to see your, you were mentioning earlier what an actor could do with a look or something, or what a director can do with, you know, with your construction.
Well, it's both completely thrilling and completely humbling. And by that I mean, to know that you wrote something that attracted the kind of talent that Captain Phillips attracted, that's really gratifying.
Well,
the humbling
yeah.
part is you see what someone like Tom Hanks brings to a movie. There's almost a magical quality to it. You see the level of ability and artistry that Paul Greengrass brings to the movie, and you begin to understand how thoroughly they beat the page. And by that I mean the script is something I'll always be proud of, but their contributions took it to another level that was almost exponential. what you come away with whenever you go anywhere near the production of a movie, and this is doubly true when you're directing it yourself, you have such a keen sense of how many people have to be on their game for that movie to be good, how many people have to be contributing at the highest level for you to get something that you're proud of. And when it all clicks in this way, and then on top of it, you have a studio that supports the movie in the way that Sony supported the movie, you know, for the last 2 or 3 weeks before that movie was released, you couldn't turn around without seeing a billboard or a commercial for Captain Phillips. They were really behind it. The cumulative effect of this is to be extremely humbled because you realize how much help you got to come up with this product that we all now are all so proud of.
It's truly an amazing feat. I got to say that, you know, I thought Tom Hanks was just fine as Captain Phillips, and then at the end of the entire movie, I mean, I was just then completely blown away by him.
So was I, and that's sort of what I'm talking about. You know, I remember seeing the movie for the first time. I was in a screening room in a basement at Sony, and as I'm watching the movie, you know, I'm very accustomed to hating a movie once I see it for the first time. And that's true of things that I've written and certainly true of the two movies that I directed, where the first time I saw it, it was just a punch in the stomach. And then I'm watching Captain Phillips for the first time, and I keep waiting for that moment when I'm going to feel like I've been punched in the stomach, but instead the movie is really working. And it was pretty close to the final cut that's in the theaters now. And I was feeling really, really good about it and really good about what Tom had done, and Paul's work is terrific. And then you get to the ending, and it goes to this other place.
Yeah.
And there's really nothing you can do at that point except just sort of take in that you're in the hands of maybe a once-in-a-generation talent in Tom, who then went to a level I'm not even sure he knew he had, and was guided there by Paul, who is just a spectacular director. Again, as I said before, it's just kind of humbling and extremely, extremely thrilling.
I can only imagine, but what an experience that must be. Let's do now discuss, you know, the Somali piracy and what causes that?
Well, there are a number of things. The first is that you have a completely failed government in Somalia and a completely collapsed economy. You know, the Somali government actually split off in 1998. There was a portion of the country that became what was known as Puntland, and Puntland formed its own government and had its own military, and then it went bankrupt in 2008 and couldn't pay the people who were in its coast guard. Naturally, these are now people who are on boats and have arms and aren't getting any money from the government. A lot of them became pirates, which is, you know, sort of a horrible irony of all this. But in 2006, the exchange rate in Somalia for $1 was 35,000 shillings. When I say collapsed economy, I mean a completely collapsed economy. There's no Walmart there for you to go get a job at. There's no economic opportunity at all for people who live there. Worse, there's no Navy. There's no Somali Navy to patrol the Somali waters, so those waters become overfished by other countries, which takes away the ability for Somalis to make a living as a fisherman. And other countries also dump their toxic waste off the Somali coast. So you have sort of a perfect storm of elements conspiring to make people turn to organized crime, which is essentially what piracy is. And it's very clear when you watch the movie that it functions in a way that's not unlike The Sopranos, that there are, you know, lower-level soldiers, and then they have to answer to their sub-bosses, and then those guys answer to the bosses, who are ultimately answering to the capos. And it's a criminal organization. And I think it's born out of, you know, this crushing poverty and despair that is Somalia. This is not meant as an excuse for piracy, and the movie doesn't make any excuses for piracy, but I think the movie is very successful in painting a picture of the bleakness that exists out there.
I can't imagine, you know, the, you know, what kind of lifestyle these people, you know, have to face every single day. And, you know,
well,
I can understand why.
It's evident in that if a pirate dies, 12 other people rush forward to take that pirate's place.
Yeah.
That should tell you something. You know, there are really two businesses in Somalia. One is piracy, and the other is the distribution and sales of khat, that's K-H-A-T, which is the weed that those pirates are chewing in the movie. You know, it's a drug, essentially, and those are really the only two businesses that exist, and those are not great options.
So we stop it by helping the Somali government? I mean, is it that easy? I mean, you know,
it's not easy. There are lots of facets to it, but yes, your instinct is absolutely right. Piracy is a problem that is taking place on the water, and yet it has to be solved on land. Okay? You need a real Somali government that has a real Somali police force and a real Somali army and a real Somali navy so that they get their waters back. All that has to take place. You also have to have real Somali prisons. You know, there are only two prisons in all of Somalia, and the rate of incarceration there is 1 in 5,000. To give you some frame of reference, in America, the rate of incarceration is 1 in 120. So you have a wildly underperforming prison system that has to be expanded. You know, now you have cases of pirates who are caught, and they're not incarcerated because there's nowhere to put them. They just cycle back into the world of piracy. So yeah, that's all got to get fixed. And you know, my opinion, and I'm not speaking here as an emissary of Captain Phillips or Sony Pictures, but my personal opinion, you have to arm the ships. You have to allow the merchant mariners to defend themselves. Now, what we're finding is that because it's going more in that direction, and container lines are allowing armed people to go on some of these trips on these boats, that Somali piracy is actually declining off the coast of Somalia itself, but it is exploding off the west coast of Africa. And as recently as a couple of days ago, there were two more Americans who were captured. You know, nothing to do for them at this point but pray. I don't know how that one's going to get resolved. You know, the Maersk Alabama, which Captain Phillips was piloting, that's the first U.S. flagged ship to be captured by Somali pirates in 200 years. That's why it was such a big deal. Last time an American flagged ship had been captured, Thomas Jefferson was the president. So this goes back a ways. It is not something that happens often, which is why the United States responded in the way that it did.
It, I'm not sure what to ask. I mean, the arming of the ships is something we can do. I mean, what do we have a responsibility? I mean, in your opinion, in terms of stopping this, is this something that?
I think we do.
Go ahead.
In any given year, $1 trillion worth of goods will pass by the Somalia coast. $1 trillion.
Jeez.
It is in everybody's best interest for those waters to be safe to pass through, just as a matter of economic sense. It's in everybody's best interest for Somalia to have a functioning government, so that they, again, have a functioning police force and a functioning military. You know, if you need an example of why that's important, take a look at the shooting in that mall in Kenya. I don't know if it was earlier this month or last month, but, you know, very recently, you know, those are Somali terrorists. It's not good for anybody to have this non-functioning state right there on the coast of Africa, where it can affect so many moving pieces of the global economy. It's a disaster for everybody. So it's in everybody's best interest to solve this problem.
Well, you know, what I gather then is you know, desperate people take desperate measures. I mean, these are not like because they're evil and they're bad people. It's because they're in a desperate situation and they're doing what they can to survive.
They may very well be evil and they may very well be bad people, and I'm not here to judge one way or the other.
Okay.
You know, I read this great saying that a pirate is only a pirate until he starts counting his money, and then he just becomes a thief. You know, we do have a tendency to romanticize what the notion of piracy is, when in fact, you know, it's really just kidnapping and thuggery and in some cases murder. You know, since the Captain Phillips incident on the Maersk Alabama, there have been 62 people who were killed by Somali pirates. You know, these are serious guys, and they do some really ugly stuff. So they may be evil people. All I'm saying is they are certainly desperate people, and it is in our best interest to remove some of those circumstances so that the world has a chance. You know,
well,
in the year before the Maersk Alabama was taken, $120 million in ransom was paid to Somali pirates. That's a lot of money. There was one ship that was taken for $10.5 million. That's not good. And as I said, for the individual sailors, the merchant mariners who are on those ships, it's not like they're coming home and getting combat pay. You know, they're being exposed to terror and death, and they're just supposed to accept it as part of their job. That doesn't seem very fair.
Right. Well. Then the bottom line, it sounds like, is that, you know, this issue doesn't need a judgment whether they're good or bad or right or wrong or evil. It just needs a solution be applied to it. Wow. Well, that's
I mean, look, part of what made Paul the right director for this movie is he really had a handle on the politics of the movie. And by that I mean, if you go look at the story, essentially, you've got Captain Phillips, who's very much a part of the global economy. And then you've got Musi, who's not at all a part of the global economy. And yet both these guys are subject to these political forces, these giant winds, over which they have no control. You know, there's a moment where Phillips and Musi are talking during the movie, and Musi's saying, look, I have bosses and they have rules. And Phillips said, we all have bosses. And it's true. They both have to answer to somebody in very different ways, but they both have these enormous pressures put on them. You know, for me, part of the fascination of the movie was what would happen if you had these two captains who both get up in the morning and get dressed and go to work. It's just that one of them is the captain of a container ship and the other is the captain of a band of pirates. What would that pressure do to them? How would they impact each other? How would they change, you know, in the crucible of those 4 days of being stuck together? That was really compelling stuff to me.
And it made a compelling movie.
Thank you.
Oh, very much so. And the comments in the chat room are, you know, that they hear your passion, you know, with this topic and with what you do as a screenwriter, director, as a storyteller, and are really enjoying it. And I just wanted
That's
to
good.
Pass that
Thank
on.
You.
Yeah, no, I very, very much so. Wow. I mean, there's
Where do you want to go next?
Really, there's so much here. Let me ask this. You know, are there? This is a compelling story, and it's well crafted as a movie, and it's well acted. But in terms of writing and advancing someone's, you know, storytelling, the elements or the critical components. I mean, we talked about story structure and McKee
sure.
earlier. Can you talk more about, you know, what the writers
sure.
can do to make better stories or tell more important
sure.
stories?
Okay. Do you know how to do the sculpture of an elephant? I'm assuming you
do.
Don't.
I don't.
Okay.
No, I don't.
The way that you do the sculpture of an elephant is you start with a block of granite and you chip away everything that is not an elephant, right? I mean, there's no other way to
right.
do it, is there?
And no
okay.
other way, no.
Okay. So in any attempt to write a screenplay, but certainly when you're writing a screenplay based on a true story, you start by building your block of Granite. And by that I mean you assemble everything you know about the world of that script, about the characters that you're going to be exploring, about the story, everything. And as I said, if it's a true story, then it's going to be a research-based endeavor. But you're just accumulating information, and it's that big block of granite. And then you step back from it. When you have written down everything you know about that world, whether it's a true story or not, in other words, 10 times more stuff about your characters than you're actually going to put in the movie. And any kind of possible story or mini story or sequences that you can fit in. Then you step back from it and you say, okay, this is everything I know about the world that I'm going to be exploring. Where's my elephant? What's the story that I'm actually telling? And that takes a little bit of time. And then once you have identified what that is, and by the way, it can and should change as you're writing, and it can and should change absolutely as you're shooting. Movies do evolve. They are living things, and they wind up saying something sometimes slightly differently, sometimes very differently than you had intended originally. And that's fine. It's part of the process. But anyway, once you've identified what your elephant is in that block of granite, then you start stripping things away that aren't that elephant, things that don't stick to the spine of your story. And once you've done all that and you have this sort of crude elephant staring at you, then you can start writing. You can actually start to tell that story. That's how I approach it.
Wow. And when it comes to, you made a comment earlier, and I want to try and, I'll just ask. After doing all of that, now you've written your screenplay, do you find in other screenplays that you've read from other people, uh-huh. Or from novices who might have given you one in the past or something like that. I'm not sure this is a fair question. Does it tend to be overwritten or underwritten? I mean, is there a particular – because you mentioned before about the actor, you know, you could be more sparing or sparse in some of the writing because the actor brought more to it or the director was bringing things to it. Do you find that there's like a condition of bad
Absolutely.
Writing or something?
Well, look, I'm asked to read screenplays for people all the time, and when I can do it, I do it because people helped me on my way up. Oftentimes, I'm just too busy. I have to say no. But I mentor a pretty fair number of people, and what I find to be the most common problem in the screenplays of inexperienced writers is not a story structure problem. It's a complete absence of subtext and a complete misunderstanding of what subtext is. And just for anyone out there who doesn't know, I mean, subtext is the stuff that's in parentheses in a screenplay. In other words, it's the stuff that's lurking beneath the text. It's actually it's there for the camera to provide. The function of the camera in a storytelling enterprise is to capture subtext. From an acting point of view, subtext is what the actor actually means by the line as opposed to the line itself. And when you're on a set, you're very rarely talking about the words. You're always talking about the intention, what the subtext of a line is, what the line is actually meaning, what the character is actually trying to accomplish. And what I find in the scripts of inexperienced writers is the characters tend to say exactly what they're thinking at all times. And it leaves no room for the actors to act. It leaves no room for the camera to reveal anything. It's just boring. And in a word that I use very carefully, it's artless. What I ask writers to do, young writers, is to sit down with their screenplay on paper and take a red pen and put a check by every line of dialogue in which the character is saying what they actually mean. If you have a lot of red checks, you have a problem, and you need to address it. What I find is that in these screenplays of inexperienced writers, and by the way, some experienced writers too, because it's a product of lazy writing, you have characters who say things like, oh, no, I don't want to go in that room because my uncle molested me in that room, and it's a horrifying experience for me, and I don't want to relive it. It's like, oh, my God, who's going to want to act that? As opposed to, a character talking about that same room saying, I don't want to go in there. I don't know what it is about that room. Maybe it's the carpets. I don't know. So maybe the lighting. Something about that room bugs me. So let's go somewhere else. Now as an audience, I'm kind of leaning forward and thinking, wait, what did he just say about that room? I know his problem isn't the carpet or the lighting. What happened to him in that room? And I'm engaged because I'm being forced to put something together. I mean, it's like a puzzle has been put in front of me, and I'm trying to figure out what that character actually meant. If you write with subtext, you're engaging your audience, and by the way, engaging your actors. So that's the biggest thing. I know that was more of an answer than you were looking for, but
No. It's a brilliant answer. I love it. I love it.
It's the biggest thing that stands out when I read the work of inexperienced writers. And by the way, I don't want to suggest that it's easy. It's not. It's really hard. And I catch myself all the time writing lines of dialogue that are on the nose. And I have to say, okay, wait, stop. We got to figure out a different way to express this. Something that is more elliptical and more has more of an allusion to it, just because, you know, I don't want to fall into that habit either. It really takes a certain discipline that you have to apply to yourself to make your characters express themselves in ways that are, frankly, more like life. If you think about the way that you talk to your boss or the way that you talk to, you know, the people in your life, you're very rarely saying exactly what's on your mind. There's always a ton of subtext going on in real-life conversations. So that should be reflected in the way you write dialogue.
Well, I do. I think that's brilliant because, you know, there's the platitude or the aphorism, you know, the idea, you know, show, don't tell.
Right.
And it seems that, you know, so much writing is exposition. You know, it's like if I tell them I'm going into the room to get the whatever, then they'll know what I'm doing.
And characters have a tendency to speak their history in
right.
The screenplays of inexperienced writers. You also have those scenes where there are two people who both know the same information and they keep saying it back and forth to each other so that we as an audience can figure it out. That doesn't happen in real life either. And by the way, when I say subtext, I also mean in terms of how you use the camera to tell the story. You know, there's a fantastic example in, many, in The Godfather, which for me is the greatest movie ever made. I don't think there's any real debate about that one. But there's this incredible moment that I always think about where Michael Corleone has come to the hospital to visit the Don after he's been shot, and Corleone moves his bed into another room to save his life. And then Michael and Enzo, the baker, have to stand out in front of the hospital and pretend they have guns on them because there are men coming to kill Marlon Brando. And they do. The car comes by, and Michael puts his hand inside his coat to pretend he has a gun, and the car drives off, and he has saved his father's life. But the moment I'm talking about is right after that. Enzo puts a cigarette to his mouth, and he can't light it because his hands are shaking so badly. And Michael takes the lighter and lights a cigarette for him. And then Michael looks at his hand and realizes that it isn't shaking at all. And it's just a moment that he just sort of clocks where you realize as a character, he just realized something about himself, which of course is what the entire movie is about. Am I going to turn into my father? I'm trying not to. I've told everyone I don't want to be that. But my inner DNA is taking me in that direction. But my point is that it's a completely visual moment. Michael Corleone never turns to the camera and says, hey, you know what I just noticed? My hand isn't shaking. God, I must be more of a killer than I thought I was. He doesn't have to say that terrible dialogue because the camera completely sold the moment for us. And when you learn the elegance of that and you actually integrate it to the point where you don't feel you need to show off with your dialogue, you just let the camera tell the story, then you've got a real shot at writing an artful screenplay.
Well, that is, again, brilliant, and I was delighted because of the show, you know, Don't Tell, when you originally, previously said, you know, you tell the story by the camera, the actor acts, the camera is, a part of that as well. So would it suffice, if nothing else, as an exercise or in practice, to write whatever you write and then go look at it and say, all right, now how do I show this instead of say this? In other words, what kind
Absolutely.
Of physical action, you know, might
Absolutely.
I do here?
Of course. I mean, the other thing I ask young writers to do is take that same screenplay when they're done with their red pen test, take a blue pen, and put a check by every moment in the screenplay in which they're telling the story visually. Hopefully you should have a lot of blue checks, but my guess is that you won't, because the characters are just saying everything. And by the way, this also extends to the way you use the camera in terms of locations as well. In other words, if you're showing a house in Act 1 and you're showing the same house in Act 3, you wouldn't want to put the camera in the same place, because then you'd be suggesting that nothing has changed over the course of the movie. It's possible that in Act 1 you show that house from a high angle and it's sort of sun-splashed and looks really friendly, and by the third act you're putting the camera at ground level right up against the house, and the house is looming huge in the frame, and it's got all these dark, foreboding shadows all over it, and you're saying with the camera, this place is really scary. You don't have a character who says that, because you've got the camera doing it for them.
No, that is excellent. That is truly excellent. Well, and now, and this, you know, your wisdom both as a writer and as a director, because I think what happens now, because anybody can make a movie where at one time they couldn't so much without a lot of money, is that, you know, in Hollywood, not everyone gets to direct their work. You know,
that's
some
right.
People do, and they've been lucky. But in the Best Buy world of filmmaking, a lot of people write screenplays and want to direct them.
That's right.
Now, the challenge of being a director who's done the screenplay has got to be, a huge issue as well, because now if you're one who writes lots of exposition and you decide, okay, everything has to be, you know, as I wrote it.
Very glad you brought that up, because it's something that I really try to impress upon people who have written and who now want to direct. This is something that I believe on an almost religious level. Writers who become directors in order to protect their work are doomed to fail. And I think they should, by the way. Because if you are directing just so you can get every single word of your screenplay onto the screen so that you can keep some other director from making changes to your work, you're going to be directing from a very rigid and I think unnecessarily rigid place. Part of the magic of movie making is you've got a lot of talented people who are all trying to reach the same goal together, and they all bring ideas and passions to it. And those ideas may be better than yours. They may have a way to express something that's more articulate, more visual, more compelling, more arresting than you had in mind. And you have to be open to that. Again, that idea of trying to beat the page. When you are directing your own work, you have to be more open to that than you've ever been before. And that's humbling too, you know, to find out that something you wrote in two paragraphs of dialogue could be expressed with a look. As I said, going back to the examples of Captain Phillips, it's humbling and thrilling at the same time. But you have to be open to that experience when you are the boss. And when you're the director, you are the boss. You're going to be the ultimate arbiter of what goes on that screen, what goes into that cut. That's when you have to be most open to the ideas of other people and most aware of the collaborative nature of filmmaking. There's no business that's close to the level of collaboration required to make a movie.
I find it interesting that, you know, in working with different directors, that there are some who, you know, it's their material and so it has to be a certain way, or
right.
There are some who focus primarily on the shot, you know, this is, oh, we got to put this shot in here, this is going to be a great shot, and they don't really care about what's in the shot, the content, the story, what's going on, as much as how, you know, it's pretty or it looks a certain way.
Yeah, but
you
those know, are guys who are just trying to build up their reel. They're not trying to tell a story. And the function of movie making is to tell a story. Everybody gets together in the weeks and months prior to shooting. You all agree to what the movie is about, what the movie is trying to say. The rich get away with murder. There is no place like home. You know, whatever it is. And then all the debates are just about what's the best way to express that idea. How can we use this beat, this scene, this sequence to express that idea in the most interesting way possible? How can that character fold into the way to express that idea? How are costumes going to help us tell that story? How is hair and makeup and music and editing and pace, how's lighting and CGI, how are all these arrows in our quiver going to conspire to help us tell that story, that's a lot of decisions. That's millions of decisions. And no one person can make them all right. The brain just doesn't function in that way. You need a lot of contributions from a lot of people. They all have to be on their best game. And I think the whole trick of directing is getting everybody focused on what the movie's about and then using the combined talents and intellects of all these people that are around you to help you get to that place. But if you're one of those people who needs to do it their way, and you can't be open to the ideas of other people, then maybe you do have to go to Walmart and buy a camera and do it yourself. And I think the results will probably be pretty poor. If you want to make a movie within the system that exists today, you're going to have to not only accept the talents of the people around you and their contributions, but be grateful for them because they're completely vital.
Wow. Wow. Very, very, very cool. I mean, I've been at table reads where, I mean, it's the first table read and some actor starts to open his mouth and the director goes, no, dude, this is how, you know, it's said. This is the person's attitude, their mind and everything.
That is not a smart director in my view. And by the way, a lot of what you're trying to achieve, particularly in working with actors, is a very open atmosphere in which ideas are welcomed. And even if you hear a horrible idea, you don't just pee on it. You pull the actor aside in a way that won't be embarrassing to anybody, and you say, well, let's talk about this choice you're making, and let's see if we can come up with a better choice. Or let's explore the choice that you're making and see where it leads us, and then we'll arrive together at the decision of whether or not that's the way we want to go. And it takes what you have to do is put aside the emotional laziness that would make somebody just say, no, bad idea. That's not how I want to do it. It takes a few more sentences to do it in a generous, kind-hearted way, but it makes your actors feel safe.
Well, it makes me really want to point out something so simple that, you know, movie making is working with others.
Right.
And it's that working in collaboration, you know, working together, whether it's your actor or your makeup artist or, you know, a craft service person or, you know, whomever, you're all working together to get this, story, this vision, you know.
Right, which is why I don't believe in a film by credit and will never believe in it. Because I've just been on enough movie sets to know how many people have to be helping you do your job. It's not a film by any one person.
Oh, aptly put. Very, very cool. Well, can I ask you, let me see how much time we have left here. We've got about, on the outside, we've got about 12 minutes left. And by the way, I've really been enjoying this. I hope at some point when you're free, and I know you're so busy that you'd come back and do this again, because you're really a wonderful guest and really am enjoying this.
I'm happy to. This may be all I know, though. I don't know if I could fill a second session.
But you know what? Even if you said the exact same thing over again, it bears repeating. I mean, I think sometimes, and that's the value of the show. People go back and listen again and again and again so that they get finally the message sinks in. But I suspect you know a whole lot more. I wanted to ask you about, you've directed and making movies. And excuse me, how did you get to direct your first movie?
Oh, Shattered Glass? Okay.
Yes,
Shattered
yes,
Glass was
yes,
originally yes. written for HBO. They had optioned an article in Vanity Fair by Buzz Bissinger, and I was hired to adapt that article. It's great, great work, by the way. Buzz is amazing. He also wrote Friday Night Lights and a bunch of other stuff. Anyway, while I was writing, the entire administration at HBO that had hired me was fired. I think that's why I write so fast now, because I want to make sure that the people who hired me still have their jobs by the time I turn in the draft. But anyway, that administration was fired, and the administration that replaced it, these were not the people who had hired me to write, to adapt Shattered Glass, and they didn't particularly care about the movie. It wasn't a movie that they wanted to make, so it just sat for 2 years. And during those 2 years, I had one or two other things made as a writer, and had made the decision that I wanted to try to direct, that it was time to see if I was grown up enough to do that job. At Shattered Glass, although it was languishing, it was literally just sitting there doing nothing, seemed like a good idea for me to turn into my first directorial effort for a couple reasons. First of all, it was a story that I was very, very passionate about, that I was never going to run out of energy telling that story. But secondly, it had no car crashes, no gunplay, nothing blew up, no nudity. It had none of those things that were just craft-driven entities that I knew I had no idea how to do. What it really required was, you know, can you capture a tone and can you get the character right? So I thought it was worth a try. So I decided I'm going to go educate myself, and I spent a lot of time talking to directors that I'd worked with and producers that I'd written for, and reading as much as I could to try to get myself ready, and then presented myself as an alternative to direct the movie, sort of attached myself to the script, and then the producer and I went out to 22 buyers. 21 of them said no. Lionsgate happily was willing to entertain the idea, so I went in for my first meeting, and I said, this is what I think the movie's about. This is how I intend to use the camera to tell that story. I'm sure that I will learn other specifics as I go, and so it may be that the specifics I'm telling you today won't be the ones I ultimately use, but I know what the story's about. I know what story I'm telling, and that will not change. And, you know, they took a chance on me, and the agreement that they and I had, and it was my idea, was I said, look, let me try to cast the movie. If I can't cast the movie, you won't have to fire me as a director. I'll quit, because the writer in me is never going to let the aspiring director in me torpedo a movie. So let me try. And they said, okay, and I went out and was able to cast the movie, and happily they were willing to make it.
Wow. Wow. I mean, again, you know, a long road around, but as so many are, but that's so cool. And then what was, for you, what was that like? I mean, you now are at the helm of your first movie working with cast. And
well, it was completely thrilling and completely terrifying. I thought they were going to fire me many different times. Many times the writer in me wanted the director in me to be fired. And the director in me felt the same way about the writer in me. But the experience is roughly akin to you're on a train track and there's a locomotive behind you going at full speed and you're running to try to keep from getting plowed over. And you don't have time to jump off the track to the right or the left. You just keep running and you hope that it runs out of steam before you do. That's what the experience of directing is like. When you're actually doing it, there's very little time to reflect. So you have to have prepared maniacally. And as I said earlier, you know, I'm not talented enough to be unprepared. So you have to really know what you're doing during those precious weeks of prep when you're getting ready to make the movie. You have to cast it in a very specific way. You have to keep rewriting the script to make sure that it's at its absolute best so that when you're hearing things in auditions that could be better lines than the lines you've written, you're including them. That you're taking into account the talents of the people that, you know, are going to be in front of the camera, learning what they can and can't do and what contributions they can make. Shot listing, you know, fanatically, so that you come to the set the best prepared person. And you also have to have an energy level that the rest of the crew is going to have to strive to match. You don't want to be the guy just sitting in a chair while everyone else is running around working their tails off, because at a certain point, they're going to wonder why they're working so hard if you're not. So you want to outwork everybody on that movie. And by the way, this is just a little bit of advice from me to anyone who directs a movie. You got to say please and thank you a lot. You got to thank every member of your crew and your cast every single day for their work. And you let them know how much you value them and how much you need them. And they'll go through fire for you.
Oh, very, very, very cool. I'm so glad you said that. And I got to tell you, yeah, we still have some moments left, but the people in the chat room and the listeners are very thrilled. They want you back. They said this is so incredibly refreshing and honest and insightful. I mean, there's so many great comments. They really do appreciate it. So we've got to have you back. And I know that my daughter will never forgive me if I don't have you back and talk about Hunger Games. So,
well, I'm happy to talk about Hunger Games, but that is very much Gary Ross's movie. He deserves the credit for it. My job on that movie was to write a draft that could get a director. That's what I did. But once Gary signed on to make that movie, it became his baby. He took over the script from there. Certainly did not need my help. He deserves the credit for what was on that screen.
Wow. That's very cool of you to say. But that in and of itself, right there, what you said is worth, again, discussing, if you would. You know, you said my job was to write a draft that would get a director and to get someone, you know, talented to sign on.
Right.
You know,
I think that the job of a screenwriter, at least in the Hollywood as it exists today, is primarily to attract talent. In other words, it's true. I wrote Captain Phillips, but I think the thing that was the biggest contribution was I wrote a draft that Tom Hanks said yes to and wrote a draft that Paul Greengrass said yes to, so that their talents could be brought to bear on the movie. I think that was really my chief function, because once you have Hanks and Greengrass and Greengrass's great editor, whose name is Chris Rouse, and his great DP, Barry Aykroyd, and you know, once you have that team, they're going to make their version of that screenplay, which is in a sense their own screenplay, because they're interpreting things and they're inventing things and they're finding things on the day. And again, I think that's all part of the process. When you're in a business as collaborative as ours, you have to understand which of those laps you're responsible for.
Well, right there. I mean, that could be a whole class in and of itself. I imagine
it absolutely could be.
How to write a screenplay to attract talent, because sure. That ultimately is the goal, is to get people to sign on, you know, who can also then get the movie made and then get it to an audience.
That's right.
You know, I think also the role of directing, which you were talking about before, and we've got about four or five minutes left, is you know, you're dealing with unions. I mean, you're dealing when you're dealing with named talent, stuff like that, you're dealing with a lot of pressure. I mean,
oh, of course,
you know, I don't know.
You signed up for it. You want that pressure.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
I can tell you, I love writing. I love being a writer. I love the lifestyle that it has afforded me, but there's no question directing is more fun. It's just a much more fun job on every level, and you know it's why writers love to direct.
True, very true. I imagine. Well, you have offered so much here, Billy. I mean, it has been an incredible time for us and for the listeners to hear your thoughts and your passions.
You know what? Again, I'm glad you said that. First of all, I very much appreciate it. But that's an example of subtext, okay, for your aspiring writers out there. If we were to actually talk about the subtext of this conversation, you could make the argument that the subtext of this conversation was that I wanted to be your favorite guest, and that I was going to do everything I could do to make sure that your listeners completely love me, right? But I'm not going to come out and say that if all this were a movie, right? So this conversation is an exercise in subtext, and I want writers out there to think of it in that way. In other words, you have a character. The character has an intention, but the character doesn't state the intention. He or she just behaves.
Well, that's very cool. I got to tell you that, and somebody actually sent me a private Twitter that said, a tweet that said, by the way, this is my favorite show with you. This is my favorite guest.
Well, that's great.
So whether you actually intended it or not, Billy, message came through loud and clear. So I have received at least one private message. It's been fantastic, and you are fantastic, and I do appreciate it. Can we say what's next, or is there a website or something that I have yet? I didn't ask.
There's no website. I'm not that sophisticated. The next thing that I'm going to be doing, which I'm extremely excited about, is I'm going to be adapting the F. Scott Fitzgerald novel, The Last Tycoon.
Oh Lord! Wow!
But as a TV series,
really?
And I'm going to run that show, and it's something that I've been developing with Sony Television. And they're in negotiations right now with a network that I cannot name, but it's the right network for this particular piece, and I'm hoping that it'll be a series on the air.
That is so cool, and I'm very fascinated. I actually had an encounter with Elia Kazan on the set of the movie The Last Tycoon back then.
Oh, is that right? Well, as you know, it's the only novel that Fitzgerald didn't finish. He died while he was writing it in 1940. So we not only have the opportunity to finish the novel for him, which is, you know, an incredible opportunity, but he's actually going to be a character in the show. Fitzgerald will be one of the characters that populates the world of The Last Tycoon.
Well, that's so cool. Well, I want to hear more about that too. And again, I want to thank you. And if when you decide that you can come back, we'd love to have you back, and we'll let listeners know when that would be. And I'll talk to you in just a couple moments after the show concludes. But thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, you bet. And have a great day. And best wishes and all.
You bet.
All right. Thank you. As Mr. Billy Ray, and what a fascinating hour it has been. I'm so glad that he was here and shared all of his insights, both about screenwriting and movie making and directing, but also about Somalia and the Merchant Marine. Very valuable information for all of us to pay attention to and to embrace and to learn from and to apply. You know, we just know about something but don't apply it. Well, you know. But I really do. I appreciate that Billy was here. Again, thank you all for joining us live, and for those who join us archived, those of you in the chat room, I appreciate you being there, and for all the messages and all the well wishes to Billy and I. That's very, very cool. Thank you for all of your support, and for tweeting and retweeting and Facebooking and Google Plusing and however you share the show with your friends and colleagues using your favorite social media means. Follow me on Twitter at Rex Sykes Movie BT, Rex Sykes Movie BT. And please do leave comments about the show at the player before you go away if you're listening live or even archived. There's a player window that's right, a comment window that's right below the player. Sometimes you have to wait until the player closes for it to become obvious. Otherwise, you just scroll down. If you're in the chat room, you just scroll down and you'll see the comment window. Do leave comments there. Leave comments at iTunes or rate and review the shows there. We appreciate that. And also, there's Rex Sykes Movie Beat Friends on Facebook. If you go to Facebook and click the like button on the friends page and join us there. It's a great way to be updated. My own website has been under construction for almost 3 years now. I'm trying to get the guys speeded up. But it's moving massive amounts of content from one site to another. And hopefully we'll be able to launch it sometime soon. But as a result, I've not been putting more written content on the site. But the interviews continue. And so they're always in the interviews blog. But if you go to Facebook, that's where I include articles and other things at Rex Sykes Movie Beat Friends. So tell your friends about that, too. Do follow on Twitter, and I really appreciate everything. All right, everybody, have a fabulous day. Make your movies and complete your projects. Until we meet the next time, that's a wrap.